Proverbs chapter 1, just a quick reminder before we get into the real meat of the sermon here together today, of the big picture of this sermon series that we are working through. It's important that we don't lose the perspective. We're talking about worship, wisdom, and work. And remember, our fundamental premise here from the Scriptures is that worship drives culture. That is, who God is and how we relate to Him is the most important thing for all of life. And that really does work itself out into a whole kind of culture. One that is more godly and pleasing to Him, or one that is more ungodly and less pleasing to Him. We need that kind of wisdom in our day and age. When many of the assumptions that undergirded certain cultural practices or ways of living and things like that are no longer with us in our society. And unfortunately, many times as Christians, we have not latched onto from the Scriptures those undergirding reasons that really give meaning to why we do what we do in our lives. That's why we started with the book of Hebrews, looking at Jesus Christ and understanding our worship in terms of Him. Jesus Christ is the one who transforms our lives into lives of true worship, because He is a superior priest offering a superior sacrifice of a superior covenant. And what we're doing when we meet together here as God's people is upholding our covenant, new covenant relationship with God. And we went back to the book of Leviticus to see how the shadow informs the substance. What is that revelation that God gave to Israel, and how does it teach us today how we ought to relate to a holy God dwelling in the midst of sinful men? But that doesn't just stop with, say, corporate worship. I'm saying this corporate worship is like the tip of the spear, so to speak, that drives everything that flows behind it, but then it does work itself out into all the rest of life. I think the book of Proverbs, the wisdom contained in there is one aspect of the Scripture that helps us to work that out. All right, to work that out, understanding who God is, knowing that, and then living that in every realm of life. There's nothing that's out of bounds, is there? There's no area of life that God says, doesn't matter, do whatever you feel like, has no bearing on your relationship with Me. It's not true, is it? We want to be people who understand that. So, we are now in the book of Proverbs, working through the wisdom the Holy Spirit has given to us through it. I'd like to begin the sermon today by telling you about two different people, Josh and Manny, we'll call them. The Christian counselor, Lou Piolo, tells about Josh. And Josh is really a compilation of many children that he has worked with and parents over the years as a counselor. He says this: Jim and Linda sat across the desk from me with tears in their eyes. They were frustrated because their 10-year-old son was so difficult to manage. Linda began their story. We can't control Joshua. He's determined to have his own way. We're embarrassed by how he talks to us. His teacher says he disrupts the whole class. She's even suggested that he may need to be placed on medication to control his behavior. We're so afraid that if Joshua doesn't get help now, he's going to be a first-class rebel in just a few years. So that's Josh. Now, let's move on to Manny. So we'll call him here. Like Josh, Manny had Christian parents. His parents, in fact, were Pietist Lutherans. There's an entry in the family Bible which reads, in the year 1724... on Saturday, the 22nd of April, at 5 in the morning, my son, Emmanuel, was born into the world, and on the 23rd received holy baptism. May God preserve him in His covenant of grace unto His blessed end, for Jesus Christ's sake. Amen. That written by his mother, a very devout woman. Manny grew up to become one of the world's most influential philosophers. His project in life, you might say, was to harmonize what we know through our senses and what we know through reason. It seemed like the philosophers in the West and Europe could not get past that impasse. And so he sought to transcend it. And he really, in doing so, set the terms of discussion for at least a century after his death. I mean, he simply dominated the discussion. He was a brilliant man. One other interesting thing about him is that he was deeply concerned with morality. He wanted to have a morality that was always binding on every person in every situation, no matter who they were or where they were. He wanted to seek out, this is what's right, and this is how you know it's right, all the time. He was very much concerned for morality. He was also, by all accounts, a very disciplined man. In fact, neighbors in the town where he lived, in fact, he was born, lived, and died in the same town, never moved, all of his 80 years. His neighbors said you could set your clocks by his regularity and his punctuality. He always did the same thing, the same time, very disciplined, throughout his whole life, till he died at 80 years of age. But this man, whom we know as Immanuel Kant, rejected the Christianity of his parents and tried to refashion his religion into a system of morality that based upon human reason. In fact, at one point, a Berlin newspaper in 1784 asked the question and solicited answers to it. What is enlightenment? That was what the newspaper asked. So Kant wrote back. He replied this, enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without the guidance of another. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. And then he wrote, sapere aude, dare to know. Have courage to use your own understanding. That is the motto of enlightenment. Have courage to use your own understanding. That's what it means to be a mature, enlightened person. And as we see from his other writings, complete freedom from anything outside myself became his objective. I know truth because of myself. He really sought to develop a philosophy of human autonomy. Manny, as we call him here, liked very much the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, Josh and Manny are two very different people in two very different situations with two very different lives. But they share something in common. They both fit into the category that the book of Proverbs names as fools. Fools. And today we're considering primarily the second half of Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. Let me read the text for us here. This really is the motto of the entire book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's what we want to consider today. How is it that a 10-year-old boy who throws temper tantrums and an old philosopher can both fit the same description? How is it they can both be classified in that way? What I want to do today is look at some of Proverbs' description of the fool, so that we'll then see more why Scripture states that the fool despises wisdom. In every manifestation of the fool, he despises wisdom. The book of Proverbs gives us, obviously, considerable nuance in our understanding of life. That's one of the objectives of the book, is to give wisdom and understanding to the simple. But still, it breaks down life into two basic categories, two basic paths. There's the path of life, and there's the path that leads to death. And you have to choose which one you're going to be on, which one you're going to follow. Now, those two paths are inhabited by two different kinds of people. There are the wise and the righteous, who walk the path of life, and there are the fools and the wicked who walk the path of death. Over here in the category of on that path to death, the category of the fools, Proverbs describes a whole range of people and their characteristics. It starts with the least problematic, you might say, and describes several different kinds all the way down to the most problematic. The least problematic, but still in this category and in a dangerous position, is a simpleton. Somebody who's simple. You might even describe them in some cases as gullible. There's nothing inherently wrong with them. They're not a rebel or something of that nature, but they're not wise. And so, because of that, they're very susceptible to the influences and the direction of fools and other kinds of people. They're very susceptible to following the wrong path because they don't know enough to know the right path, know it rightly. As we're talking about last week, the book of Proverbs means knowing. Now, beyond that though, the Proverbs uses three different terms to describe a fool. It works its way, by the way, all the way down to a scorner, a mocker. These categories overlap, of course. They're not hard and fast categories, but they point out certain characteristics of people. Pardon me. I think the Holy Spirit uses these three primary terms, or translated fool or folly, to help us understand a little bit more of what it is we're talking about. So we're going to look at just part of, and this is emphasized, it's just part of what the Scripture talks about here in the book of Proverbs, as describing the fool. We're not going to deal at all with one description of the fool, which you might be familiar with from the Bible and other places, from the term Nabal, or you've heard the story of Nabal and Abigail, his wife. He was not a very wise man in the way he related to David, for example, and just about got himself killed by David because of it. All right? Why did the Bible call him that? Because that's what he was. And that's the term, actually. That's the Hebrew word for fool. But Proverbs actually only uses that term a couple times when talking about the fool. It really emphasizes a couple other terms which I want to use in our exposition here today. The term used in our text, when it says fools despise wisdom and instruction, we could even render it in a little bit more colloquial English, idiot or blockhead. Somebody who's thick, who doesn't get things. But it's not necessarily referring to someone who has little mental capacity or little intellectual capability. A fool can be somebody who, say to use a modern terminology, would have an extremely high intelligence quotient, IQ. He might be extremely intelligent in that way. He might even be, in some aspects of his person and personality, a very charming person, a very witty person. He might be a very influential person. And yet he can still fall under this characteristic described as a fool. How does Proverbs describe this one who despises wisdom and instruction? I'm going to start off with some texts that point to the fact that the fool's problem is something that is very deeply entrenched in the core of his being. The fool is someone who has a heart problem. Look with me first of all to Proverbs chapter 10 verse 21. Proverbs chapter 10 verse 21. Here it says, "The lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of sense." It's translated here, lack of sense. We could take a very literal translation of this phrase, which to my knowledge no English translation does. And that is a lack of heart. That's the term that's used there for sense or wisdom. It's the word for heart. The fool lacks heart. Now, as you know from the Scriptures, a heart is a very multidimensional term in the Scriptures, but it always refers to the core of our being. That which is really the essence of who we are. It's from the heart that comes everything about us. All of our thoughts, all of our desires, our wisdom or the lack thereof, our character. That's our heart. It even includes in some usages like a cognitive idea, our thinking ability and things of that nature. But it always has a moral component as well. And the fool here is described as someone who does not have a heart. And so in this particular proverb, we see that though a fool can be surrounded with life-giving instruction, he doesn't receive it. And so he dies. He in effect starves to death, even when food is all around him, because he can't take it in. The lips of the righteous feed many. Okay, there's abundant provision here. There's life-giving food on offer. And yet the fool dies. Why? He lacks heart. He lacks sense. He doesn't have the capability to receive it. He's senseless, lacking wisdom, because of this problem at the core of his being. And so, in the same chapter here, because he cannot receive life-giving instruction, he has to be treated with force. Proverbs 10 verse 13 says, "On the lips of him who has understanding, wisdom is found, but a rod is for the back of him who," here's that same phrase, "lacks sense," who lacks a heart. Okay, how does he have to be treated? Because he doesn't have a heart. He has to be treated with a rod, just like a brute beast, almost. In fact, we learn from Proverbs chapter 9 that the woman wisdom and the woman folly both call out to this man to receive them. But the woman folly, as this man hears her voice, he does not perceive that the dead are in her house. He does not know that the dead are there, and her guests are in the depths of Sheol. So I want to point out first of all here, as we're talking about a fool, is his core problem is his heart. It's a moral problem. It's not that he lacks intellectual capabilities. It's that he won't receive wisdom because of the way his heart is. And what happens to a man like that? Right away, Proverbs tells us, and we'll see this more as we go a little bit deeper into the book of Proverbs, that he's on the path that leads to death. It will destroy him. When I was in high school, I had a friend, a good friend of mine, named Wayne. Wayne came from a very poor family, unfortunately, whose parents, though married, were fools in the biblical sense of the term. Wayne often had to help his own parents home from the bar at night because they were too drunk to get there on their own. But Wayne had a younger brother and kind of a late addition to the family, so to speak. And his name was Robbie. Robbie would sometimes come to church, not Wayne came faithfully. Robbie would sometimes come. But Robbie was known far and wide in the little communities where we lived as being quite an ornery critter. And in some ways you understand the upbringing that he had. But Robbie was not known for one who listened well. One who received instruction. Robbie was very much known as an angry person. Even at the tender age of 12. But one day, Robbie, for whatever reason, ended up out in a pasture, of course this is a rural area, with another foolish young man, 15 years old, and nobody knows exactly what happened that day. Unfortunately, not only because of the scenario, but because the later investigation done by the sheriff's office was extremely poorly done, and therefore nothing much could even be determined in a court of law. But at the end of the day, the story was that there was an argument of some kind, and at the end of the day, Robbie was dead. Shot through the head with a .22 rifle. I'll never forget that funeral as a young high school student myself. the family grieving as a family that had no hope because they didn't. Taking a long procession to the Hillcrest Cemetery where he was buried. But it made a lasting impression in my life that the way of a fool leads to death. I don't even know particular culpability in that situation, the particular situation in which he died. But I do know there was a way of life in both of the young men involved that led to death. It's a hard lesson to learn in that way. That's exactly what Proverbs holds up before us as, this is the way of a fool. And these are the characteristics that Proverbs then begins to unpack a little bit for us that lead this way. When a person has a heart problem like this, he ends up going to the way of death. Because of his heart problem, Proverbs says that a fool actually enjoys doing foolish things. That's what he loves to do. Proverbs 15:21. Folly is a joy to him who lacks sense. Same description here, lacks a heart. Folly is a joy to him who lacks sense, but a man of understanding walks straight ahead. Maybe it's the fool risking his life and others' lives through reckless driving. Maybe it's getting his kicks out of seeing what he can get away with, like petty thefts or minor misdemeanors, vandalizing somebody else's property, just to see if he can get away with it. It's fun, you know. Exciting. Maybe it's refusing to work, sitting around playing computer games all day long. Hey, I enjoy that kind of thing, the fool says. I love my folly. Maybe it's playing with fireworks when there's a burn ban in effect. Maybe it's arguing with authorities just because he finds a secret joy in making them squirm. Challenging them, poking their authority, seeing what he can get away with. Folly is a joy to him who lacks sense. He has a deep heart problem. Now, part of the challenge that Proverbs puts before us is that we all start our lives with this kind of a problem. Proverbs 22, verse 15 tells us that folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child. It's not something that comes from outside of him, per se, that makes him this way and forces him to be that way against his will. It comes from his own heart. And he acts this way because that's who he is at the core of his being. That's what he loves. That's what he enjoys. And we all start that way, don't we? We all start off life as little fools. That's why Proverbs stresses the proper discipline of children. The rod of discipline drives it far from him. Now, one member of our bodies that starts to reveal the heart problem of foolishness over and over is mentioned in the book of Proverbs, and that's the tongue. The fool's mouth shows a lot about what his heart is like. Go back to chapter 10 just for a minute. Proverbs chapter 10. It says verse 8 here, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 8, the wise of heart will receive commandments, but a babbling fool will come to ruin. A babbling fool is how it describes him here. Verse 10, whoever winks the eye causes trouble, but a babbling fool will come to ruin. Verse 14, the wise lay up knowledge, but the mouth of a fool brings ruin near. Just the opposite of a wise man. A wise man is like a farmer who's laying by in store. He knows how to produce a good crop through the way he uses his mouth. What does a fool do? He starts the field on fire and burns it down with his mouth. So there's nothing left. It brings ruin near. Go over to chapter 14 and verse 3. By the mouth of a fool comes a rod for his back, but the lips of the wise will preserve them. He almost invites discipline, He invites a beating, so to speak, because of the way he uses his mouth. That's a fool. Proverbs 15, verse 2. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of fools pour out folly. What's in the heart comes out. It's revealed in the mouth. Shows itself. Verse 14 of the same chapter. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feed on folly. Here, almost the reverse image of the one we just looked at. Pouring out folly. Now, he loves to take in folly and devour it. That's what he enjoys. That's what the mouth of the fool is like. The heart problem of foolishness also comes out in the fool's attitudes, particularly in the attitude of self-sufficient pride. A fool is very cocksure of his own way of life. He knows, and he doesn't need anybody else to teach him anything. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15 says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice." This is the attitude of a fool. He's right. Everybody else is wrong. He really thinks very highly of his own opinions. He's unwilling to learn from others. In fact, Proverbs 15, verse 5 says that he despises his father's instruction. He doesn't need to learn from his father. Why should I learn from somebody older than me? I know what I need to know. I'm good enough. In fact, in our day and age, this thing is almost trained into us through the youth culture that characterizes our society. We no longer honor the aged, we honor youth. You want to be young, right? And the last thing you want to do is look like your parents and dress like your parents and listen to the music that your parents listen to and go to the places your parents go and on down the line. You wouldn't want to be like that. That's, according to the fools of our age, that's silly. That's stupid. Well, what does Proverbs say? That's foolishness. That whole attitude is foolishness. The fool even, according to chapter 19, verse 3, blames God for the problems which his own foolishness causes. Look at chapter 19, verse 3. When a man's folly brings his way to ruin, his heart rages against the Lord. A fool is one who will never admit that he was wrong and that perhaps he caused the problems that he got into. It's God's fault that I'm this way or that this happened to me. I know I was lazy and I didn't earn enough money and I didn't pay my bills and I got credit card debt. But it's God's fault that my life is a wreck and I can't afford anything right now. Why did he do this to me? That's a fool. He won't acknowledge his own contribution to why he's in the position he's in life. Instead, he rages against God. In fact, this attitude, this self-sufficient pride, comes out even when others try to instruct him. Just look at one text, Proverbs 29, verse 9. If a wise man has an argument with a fool, the fool only rages and laughs, and there is no quiet. What does he do? Does he meet wisdom, good reason, sound reason, with sound reason? No. He engages in what's sometimes in debate called ad hominem attacks. He laughs, he mocks, he makes fun of his opponent. Whatever he can do to discredit him, he just laughs and rages. There's no quiet. You can't get anywhere with him because he's not interested in really learning anything. All he cares about is making a mockery of somebody else to make himself look good. That's the kind of person he is. In fact, Proverbs 14, verse 8 says that a fool will be deceived by his way. Let me read that text. 14, verse 8. The wisdom of the prudent is to discern his way, but the folly of fools is deceiving. The fool all this time thinks he's right. He knows he's right. And nobody can tell him otherwise, and he's deceived by his very way. He can't even see what he's doing to himself. The fool also then is impatient and unwise. And so according to chapter 12, verse 16, he flares up immediately when anything bothers him. The vexation of a fool is known at once. But the prudent ignores an insult. The fool has a quick temper many times. Chapter 14, verse 7, a man of quick temper acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. And so a fool quarrels easily. Chapter 20, verse 3. Pardon me. It is an honor for a man to keep aloof from strife, but every fool will be quarreling. We also learn from chapter 27, verse 3, that a fool, because of this characteristic, is provoking to those around him. A stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but a fool's provocation is heavier than both. You have a real hard time putting up with a fool. He wears your patience thin. And there's almost, as the proverb points out, there's also almost nothing heavier in life to try to deal with than having to live with somebody who's a fool. You might have to bear great burdens in life, but a fool is heavier. And because he has these characteristics that we've just been talking about, chapter 17, verse 12 says, it's dangerous to deal with a fool. Let a man meet a she-bear robbed of her cubs, rather than a fool in his folly. It would be better for you to run into a bear out in your hikes here in the forest than it would be to run into a fool. That's how seriously Proverbs, and in fact how dangerous the fool can be because of these characteristics we've just been talking about. Proverbs goes on to describe a fool as someone who can become so hardened that disciplining them in fact becomes foolishness. The instruction of fools is folly, it says in 16:22. His folly can become so much a part of his character that it's impossible to separate it from him. As chapter 27, verse 22 says, crush a fool in a mortar with a pestle, along with crushed grain, yet his folly will not depart from him. It's too much a part of who he is. In fact, as we mentioned earlier, he likes his folly. He loves that. And so no matter how disgusting it is, he returns to it. Proverbs 26:11, like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. I want to close with one more description of the fool. Close our description of a fool here with one more description from the book of Proverbs. Because I think this text shows the deep religious problem, the deep worship problem, the deep heart problem of the fool. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 9. Chapter 14 verse 9 says this. Fools mock at the guilt offering, but the upright enjoy acceptance. Now let me just pause for a moment here to talk about the meaning of the text. Probably many of you are reading, I'm reading from the English Standard Version here, many of you are reading from a different version, which might say that fools mock at sin. Alright? Same term. Asham. You remember when we were studying through Leviticus and we talked about the major offerings that God gave to Israel? One of those was the guilt offering, or we can even call it the reparation offering. In the book of Leviticus, the term, elsewhere translated sin or guilt, is the same exact term. And yet it's talking about an offering there. An offering for this purpose, for the purpose of dealing with guilt, reparation in particular, as we'll talk about more in just a minute. So you say, in this proverb, which one is it? Is it primarily focused on the guilt of the sin itself that fools mock at? Or is it saying the actual guilt offering that fools mock at? It could go either way, and there are arguments on both sides. One of the arguments for translating it like it is here in the English Standard Version is just even the terminology employed in the second part of the proverb. You know how proverbs employ parallelism and they tend to reflect each other? It says the upright enjoy acceptance. That term acceptance really has reference to acceptance before God. A relationship with God, kind of an idea. And if that's the focal point of this proverb, then it may very well be that it's emphasizing the aspect of guilt offering and the relationship with God that that implies. Now, having said that, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the impact of this proverb which way we take it, because both of them are true, especially in the Old Testament system. If a fool mocked at guilt, would he care about offering a guilt offering? No. If he mocked at the guilt offering, what did that show about his character? He didn't care about guilt, sin, his relationship with God. And that's exactly the point. The fools mock that guilt offering. Let me just pause for a moment to remind us what we studied in the book of Leviticus about the guilt offering. Back there, God gave instructions for this guilt, or sometimes called reparation offering. And the function of this particular offering was to pay for damages done by sin. That's what its point was. In order to put something or someone back into a right relationship with the Lord, that holy relationship with the Lord, there had to be reparation. And remember, we saw in that another dimension of the problem of sin. The whole burnt offering dealt with reconciliation, because sin produces wrath and enmity. The sin offering dealt with purification, because sin produces corruption and defilement. The guilt offering dealt with sanctification, because sin desecrates and pollutes. When men break faith with God, and that's the term often used in Leviticus, they break faith, they're treacherous against God. When they break faith with God, they commit sacrilege, and that requires payment. The guilt offering clearly reveals that sin damages the Lord's holy goods, whether that's people or property, and so there must be reparation in order for a person or a thing to be reinstated as holy, set apart to the Lord. So when God gave Israel the guilt offering, He was really giving them a way to remain as His holy people, with His holy presence dwelling in their midst. He was giving them the gift of sanctity. But according to this text, the fool doesn't care about that. He mocks that. He doesn't care. He really doesn't care about being in a right relationship with God. And therefore, he can actually go so far as to mock sin and mock those who would engage in the worship of the holy God in their midst. He doesn't care about that. You see, sin means nothing to a fool. He sees no need for reparation, no need for payment for his sins. His sins don't weigh on him that heavily. And I think his attitude toward God actually even plays out in his attitude toward others, as we see in other places in the book of Proverbs. A fool does not care about making things right with others when he has wronged them. Reparation, you know, say seeking forgiveness and restitution or things of that nature, they don't matter to him. If he has sinned against someone else, he's not going to go back and seek forgiveness. If he's damaged somebody else's property, that's their problem, not his. That's the way a fool thinks of life. Because it goes back to this fundamental relationship between him and God. He makes a mock at the guilt offering. He doesn't see himself as a sinner in need of this offering for his sin so that he can be right with God. And thus, fools are people who destroy life. They destroy relationships. They destroy families. They destroy societies because they will not deal with sin in God's way. The fool mocks sin because he doesn't care about living in God's holy presence. And that's why I say foolishness is ultimately a worship issue. It's a heart issue. Fools despise wisdom, to go back to our text where we started, because fools despise God. So, how could Immanuel Kant be considered a man who despised wisdom? He spent his life pursuing it, didn't he? Well, the answer is, at the end of the day, no. He did not. He spent his life on a quest for human autonomy, and while there are many facets of common grace at work in his life, after all, it is better to live a life of self-disciplined productivity than a life of dissolution and a total lack of self-control, Kant would not start with the fear of the Lord. He rejected that. He knew that, but he rejected it. And therefore, his gargantuan intellectual labors produced idolatry. The moral deficiency in his character was his refusal to submit to Jesus as Lord and to worship him. In fact, Kant scorned worship. He wanted only a religion that was good for morality. That's what he wanted. Make men good people. But that worship stuff, praying, singing, we don't need any of that. Get rid of it. It's interesting that, by the way, one man has said this noun, folly, can be described as moral corruption from the standpoint of its impact on judgment and reason. I find a deep irony in that, because here's a man who is known for his study of judgment and reason. In fact, it's even in the title of some of his major works of philosophy. He's a man who had the moral corruption of the heart, which led him away from the truth. And so, the little boy is throwing a temper tantrum, and the great philosophers who reject Jesus Christ really do have a lot in common, don't they? They are both fools. I'm going to close today by asking, how about you? What about you in your life? Are you a person who despises wisdom and instruction because you don't fear the Lord? I hope you've seen today, just from the brief, we could have talked about so much more about the fool from the book of Proverbs, but brief touching on who a fool is and what he's like, that you'll see the warning here. Beware of despising wisdom and instruction. Instead, be those who seek out wisdom and instruction. That's what you need. That's why, for instance, one of the reasons that would draw you here this morning, right? Why should I come? Why should I worship Jesus Christ? Why should I bow the knee to Jesus as Lord and hear His word preached and try to get instruction? Is it because the preacher's so smart? In fact, I read one man wisely said recently, you know, one of the reasons God has you learn through preachers is because it's a good exercise in humility. You have to learn to listen to somebody who doesn't know as much as you do. And that's why God has you do it. It's true a lot of times, isn't it? It really is. God has us do these things because we need this. We need to learn to fear Him, to welcome and receive instruction. And He gathers us together in His great wisdom. He ordained that His people would gather together to draw near to Jesus Christ, to fellowship around His Word, to learn from Him, because they're lovers of wisdom, because they're not fools. By contrast, people who see no need for themselves to have this kind of thing, I really do know more than that preacher does, may very well be the truth. But what's your heart like? What do you want? What are you after in life? Do you want to worship Him? That's why we engage in things like education. From a Christian perspective, education really is just a search for wisdom. That's what it is. It's not human autonomy trying to make ourselves into the next Einstein or anything of that nature. It's a search for wisdom. We want to know Jesus Christ. And that means we have to develop and study and learn and search out, taking all the God-given capacities that He's given to us in the world that He's made for us, that reveals Himself to us, and we dig in, and we study, and we learn more, and it's just unending the new things we can uncover. For the person who's wise, they love to learn. They love to learn. Let me just give a word of exhortation to the young people here today. As your mothers and fathers get you up in the morning and say, okay, here's your assignments for the day. Do you rejoice in that? Or is your heart, why do I have to learn to read? Why do I have to learn to write? Why do I have to learn my arithmetic? What are you showing about yourself? There's some folly starting to come out, isn't there? Your parents know you need this if you're going to know God rightly and walk with Him faithfully in your life. It ought to become a delight to you to have hard things that you have to study. Sometimes frustrating things that you have to learn that you can't quite seem to get. You know what God is doing? God is using your parents to stretch you. Stretch your mind, stretch your heart, so you'll understand Him and His ways more. Be able to respond to Him more and glorify and enjoy Him more. You know what? A person with a little mind has a very little cup full for joy. He can't experience very much joy because he can't take it in. But as he submitted himself to God's discipline in his life and learned and grown, never ending in life, really. You're not done learning when you're 18. You're just expanding your whole life to a huge lake of joy that never runs dry. And life is wonderful. Life is amazing. Life is exciting and exhausting. Exhausting, that's not the word I meant. But it's exciting anyway. Maybe exhausting too sometimes, because we can never plumb the depths of all of who God is, can we? And we can spend our life enjoying that, just as a preparation even for greater things in eternity. So young people, listen to your parents. Learn to love your siblings. That's the school of wisdom that God has you in right now. Don't start exhibiting the characteristics of a fool in your relationships at home. Don't enjoy your foolishness. That's what the fool does. He loves his folly. You know, the Proverbs teaches us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction.